good story. You know, it's very odd. There's a drama in a film called Tom and Viv that puts all the blame on Elliot. If you hear his name now, there was no recognition of the 50th anniversary of his death. The only thing you read about him now is he was anti-Semitic. In a series of lectures he gave in 1933, he made the comment that cultures should be uniform in language, in religion, and that one should not allow the Jews too much control, because they will undermine any culture whatsoever. Well, you know, many of his friends who were Jewish abandoned him, never spoke to him again, and the publication of that book, of the lectures called The Sacred Wood, was never republished. You can't even find a copy now. But they pull that out as a club to beat him with. What's very interesting, the great Solzhenitsyn, I think the greatest writer of the 20th century, anti-Semitic. Eliot, the greatest English poet of the 20th century, anti-Semitic. It's just, you know, on and on and on. So when people say, you know, well, so-and-so was anti-Semitic, my response now is no. Mr. Solzhenitsyn, Mr. Eliot was pro-Christ. Not anything. Pro-Christ. And it tends to shut people up. I thought what I'd do, I'm going to read through part three, the fire sermon. Just read it, okay? I'll do it again at Margate. So if you hear it twice in one day, you can stand it. You're up to it. The fire sermon, as I said, I gave you the background. The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. The nymphs are departed. And their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed, have left no addresses. By the waters of Leman I sat down and wept. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long, but at my back in a cold blast I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckle spread from ear to ear. A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank, while I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening round behind the gas house, musing upon the king my brother's wreck, and on the king my father's death before him. White bodies naked on the low damp ground, and bones cast in a little low dry garret, rattled by the rat's foot only year to year. But at my back from time to time I hear the sound of horns and motors, which shall bring Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They wash their feet in soda water. Et oh, ces voix d'enfants chantant dans la coupole. Twit, 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 jug, jug. Jug, 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 so rudely forced, terroot. Unreal city, under the brown fog of a winter morn, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven, with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents at sight, asked me in demotic French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. At the violet hour when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi throbbing, waiting, I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour, the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time, clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the window perilously spread, her drying combinations touched by the sun's last rays. On the divan are piled, at night her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I too awaited the expected guest. He, the young man carbuncular, arrives, a small house agent's clerk, with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended. She is bored and tired, endeavors to engage her in caresses which still are unreproved, if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. And I, Tiresias, have forsuffered all, enacted on this same divan or bed. I, who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead, bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done, and I'm glad it's over. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again, alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. This music crept by me upon the waters and along the strand, up Queen Victoria Street. Oh, city, city, I can sometimes hear beside a public bar in Lower Thames Street the pleasant whining of a mandolin and a clatter and a chatter from within, where fishmen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr hold inexplicable splendor of Ionian white and gold. The river sweats oil and tar, the barges drift with the turning tide, red sails wide to leeward swing on the heavy spar, the barges wash drifting logs down Greenwich Reach, past the Isle of Dogs. Vi-la-la-la-ya, va-la-la-ya-la-la. Elizabeth and Lester beating oars, the stern was formed a gilded shell, red and gold. The brisk swell rippled both shores, southwest wind carried downstream the peal of bells, white towers. Vi-la-la-la-la-ya, va-la-la-la-la-ya-la-la. Trams and dusty trees, Highbury bore me, Richmond and Kew undid me. By Richmond I raised my knees, supine on the floor of a narrow canoe. My feet are at Moorgate, and my heart under my feet. After the event he wept, he promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent? On Margate sands I can connect nothing with nothing, the broken fingernails of dirty hands, my people, humble people who expect nothing. La la. To Carthage then I came, burning, 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 burning. O Lord, thou pluckest me out. O Lord, thou pluckest, burning. It's just an extraordinary piece of work. Just unbelievable. Well, you'll hear that delightful section again this afternoon. Where it was written, where the last half of it was written. Part four, very short. I mentioned it before. The first volume that he wrote, the Prufrock Poems, 1917, dedicated for Jean Verdinal, 1889 to 1915, Mort aux Dardanelles. Ship went down in the Dardanelles where he drowned. I'm convinced this is a little tribute, because it's the first moment of healing in the poem. It's the dry, dead earth. We are suddenly in the water, and the water is washing, okay? Simply called Death by Water, A Return to Nature. Yes, there's the classical name, the classical references, the return to the basic elements, the burial at sea, the quiet cleansing, and the whole dirt of the modern life in the city is cleared away, washed away. We have a very brief return to one of the great truths, which is simply life is short, and you don't know when it's going to end. Okay. Part four, Death by Water. Phlebas the Phoenician, a fortnight dead, forgot the cry of gulls and the deep sea swell and the profit and loss. A current under sea picked his bones in whispers. As he rose and fell, he passed the stages of his age and youth, entering the whirlpool. Gentile or Jew, O you who turn the wheel and look to windward, consider Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you. Notice a change in tone. Complete change in tone. But the other thing that's fascinating here, please notice that the healing the modern world needs, the purification that is necessary for anything to be renewed, begun, continued, recreated, comes through the application of water. I see this as Eliot having become, whether he knew it or not at this point, so convinced of original sin that in the midst of this poem of the collapse under the weight of original sin denied by the modern world, we get an image of baptism, cleaning, washing, purifying. Here it comes at the moment of death, at the moment of death. But we know that even at that last moment, it's possible. I'm going to take the time and tell this story. Some of you already know this. When I began teaching at the Naval Academy, a young woman across the hall, a lovely woman, taught the Romantic poets, hadn't married. Again, one of those women teachers who loved poetry and taught it very well. She was my age. She had arrived a year before I did. She became engaged to get married to a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He was a good bit older. They were very happy together. She came in one morning, walked into my office and said, "I haven't slept for 3 nights. I have this pain in my stomach." I had an instant sensation of what was coming. And I said, "Nancy, you've got to get to the doctor at once." She had been raised Jewish. She didn't practice the Jewish faith. Had no faith at all. We'd had some quiet talks about it, but she wasn't interested. She went through a year of unspeakable suffering. By noon, she had been told she had ovarian cancer. She went through chemotherapy, lost all her hair, was in constant pain. Chemotherapy is an ugly process in itself. And then she had an uncle who was a famous surgeon who did 2 operations on her and later told her before she died he knew the case was hopeless, but he was able to do some experimentations on his own niece through the surgery. Her own uncle did this. Her fiancé was very good to her, was there with her as much as he could. She tried to come back and teach. It wasn't possible. I was leaving for the summer. I knew I wouldn't see her again. I said a kind of goodbye to her. I called her during the summer. She could barely talk. Her mouth was filled with boils, and it was an ugly death. I came back in the fall, and she had died. And I got a call from her fiancé asking if I would help him close up her apartment. Her mother couldn't bear to come down from Philadelphia to do it. Could we load things? Would I help him load things in the truck and he would drive it back to Philadelphia? I said, "Of course I'll be there." So he showed up early in the morning with the moving van and a 0.5 gallon of gin. And we worked all day loading the truck, and to bear the pain, we would occasionally have a shot of gin and keep going and learn until finally we came to the point there were 2 folding chairs left and a little bit of gin in the bottom of the bottle. So we sat on the folding chairs, shared the last drops of gin, gave a toast, and I said, "Who would have guessed that it would come to this?" And he said, "Well, at least it has a happy ending." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You don't know?" I said, "No, what? He said, "An hour before she died, she who had gone occasionally to, he was Anglo-Catholic, but she had gone with him to the services, and she said to him 1 hour before she died, There's much about your Christian faith I don't understand, but I understand the sufferings of the cross. I want to be baptized. He ran around the hospital, couldn't find a priest, a minister. No one was there. The clock was ticking. He knew it. He got the water. He knew the proper rite. He baptized her. She was baptized at the moment she died. There's much about your religion I don't understand, but I have come to understand the sufferings of the cross. The very thing the modern world is trying to get rid of, not believing in suffering. When we know suffering was our salvation, suffering and death can still be our salvation. It's a death by water. You can see there a hint that Eliot, who is searching, is at least somehow in his heart knowing where the search must go, where the search must go. All right, the final part, let's go through it. What the thunder said. Your Excellency marks it as a quasi-solution. I would emphasize the quasi more than solution, but it is... There is something there at the end. Eliot combines different things. One, we begin in Gethsemane, absolutely. Passion and death, okay? An hour, just a hint of positive renewal again. There's a chance that rain will come to this dry earth. We get back to the ruined landscape, nightmare images. There is no rain, but there's a hope, a prayer of it. There's a journey through the desert that echoes the journey to Emmaus. You'll hear the echoes there. There's a mysterious extra traveler, okay? Then there's a vision of the collapse of Eastern Europe, the collapse of London, of the cities being turned upside down again and dead, waterless. And then we finally come to the Chapel Perilous, which is a terrifying place. We arrive at the one point where there can be healing. And it's a frightful place, but one has to be there in order for the knight to restore the wounded fisher king. And then some rain does come. Then the thunder speaks powerfully. It may be a godlike voice, but it's from the east, and we're suddenly into hints of the Hindu religion. After we had the Buddhism, we had the, as I said, he's searching. He's looking at them all, one after another. And we get the God of Thunder speaking three words. You'll find them. The first is give. And it be a hint of we must be charitable. The second, sympathize. Every human being in the modern world locked in his own prison. And the key, how does the key turn? What gets us out of the prison? We don't know, but at least we have to sympathize because we're all prisoners locked in separate cells. And finally, control, a hand that guides. It is possible to maintain order and have some sense of direction. And you'll notice the image he uses is indeed of a sailboat. And in a way, we're back to his youth in Gloucester, Massachusetts, when he learned sailing. And he learned control by being able to control that sailboat as he became a very good sailor and was able to do just that. And then the conclusion of a last glimpse of the Fisher King. And we are given the final words, Shanti, 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 peace, peace, peace. Let me read through what the thunder said, and we'll finish up the wasteland. After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains, he who was living is now dead. We who are living are now dying with a little patience. Here is no water but only rock, rock and no water in the sandy road, the road winding above among the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink. Amongst the rock, one cannot stop or think. Sweat is dry, and feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rock, dead mountain mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Here one can neither stand, nor lie, nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red, sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. If there were water and no rock, if there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock, if there were the sound of water only, not the cicada and dry grass singing, but sound of water over a rock where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 but there is no water. Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman, but who is that on the other side of you? What is that sound high in the air, murmur of maternal lamentation? Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains? Cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air, falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings, and bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward down a blackened wall, and upside down in air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours, and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. In this decayed hole among the mountains, in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing over the tumbled graves, about the chapel. There is the empty chapel, only the wind's home. It has no windows, and the door swings. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the rooftop, cocorico, cocorico, in a flash of lightning, then a damp gust bringing rain. Ganga was sunken, and the limp leaves waited for rain, while the black clouds gathered far distant over Himavant. The jungle crouched, humped in silence. Then spoke the thunder. Da! Data! What have we given? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender which an age of prudence can never retract, by this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries, or in memories draped by the beneficent spider, or under seals broken by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. Da! Dayadvam! I have heard the key turn in the door once, and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison, thinking of the key, each confirms a prison. Only at nightfall, ethereal rumors revive for a moment a broken Coriolanus. Da! Damyata! The boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. I sat upon the shore, fishing, with the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. Posca sose nel fuoco che le offina, quando fiam, uti celadon. Oh, swallow, swallow, la prance d'Aquitaine a la tour aboli. These fragments I have shored against my ruins. Why then I'll fit you. Hieronymo's mad again. Data. Dayadvam. Damyata. Shanti. 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 Whew. Whew. Absolute masterpiece. Totally unique. Totally original. Unlike anything ever written by anyone, but our time, our age, our world cannot be expressed, discussed, presented, thought about in any of the old terms. And yet, all that past is there. It is still there. It is still informing in a way. But what Eliot does is take it and make it new and make it absolutely his own. Just astonishing. Let me end by saying this. And I think it's of some interest. The poem concludes. It's very clear by the end we've come to some sort of place. I don't know exactly what one would call it. Another of those great lady teachers who taught poetry, her name was Helen Gardner. Before she died, she became Dame Helen Gardner, and she deserved it. She wrote a wonderful book called The Art of T.S. Eliot. She loved Eliot, knew his poetry very well, understood much of the mechanics of it better than Eliot himself did, I think, explained to him what he had written. They came to be very good friends, okay? But again, it's what he said earlier. There are things a poet does that he himself doesn't know that others may see. Well, Dame Helen, God bless her, saw things, understood them. Here are her comments about the end of the wasteland. The wasteland moves, if it moves at all. And her vision is it's a shocking picture of where we are, even though there is some movement in it. The wasteland moves, if it moves at all, towards some moment which is outside the poem. As I said, Eliot is seeking, but he doesn't find the answer there. There's an answer, but it seems to be outside the poem and may never come, which we are still waiting for at the close. We have a sense the land may be healed. Healing is possible. But at the end of the poem, the wasteland is still waste. The healing has not yet come. Her other comment. The poem does not so much move towards a solution as make clearer and clearer that a solution is not within our power. We can only wait for the rain to fall. The solution to the modern problem, Eliot suggests, will come from outside and above. We cannot clean up the mess we have made. And what Helen Gardner understands there is something that's going to permeate the rest of my talks on Eliot, and that is the mystery of waiting, 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 waiting in this modern mess, but waiting with hope, because the solution is there, the rain will come, it is possible, but we are not going to fix the mess. We made the mess, we are not going to fix the mess, but that doesn't mean the individual soul cannot prosper and survive in the midst of the mess, but our job is waiting and suffering. I'll come back to that often during the rest of these talks. Now, what Eliot does do there, this is from an essay he wrote in 1935. Oh, wait, I jumped one last thing. The month after the poem was published, in England, October 1922, published in America in November 1922. In December, It's still November, November 1922. He writes an obituary. He was doing something called the London Letter in the magazine he was publishing. A very famous English performer had died. Her name was Marie Lloyd, and she was a music hall performer. And as I said, from his youngest days, Eliot loved the music hall, loved it. Loved the energy, loved seeing the performers, had an ear to that kind of music. It shows up in The Wasteland. Oh, that Shakespearean rag, okay? Which was an actual song he heard about that came, I think, from Australia or New Zealand. And in it went, okay? Well, Marie Lloyd died, and he viewed it as the end of an era. Something had finished. This is the end of his obituary, which is a tribute to Marie Lloyd. With the dwindling of the music hall, by the encouragement of the cheap and rapid-breeding cinema, the lower classes will tend to drop into the same state of amorphous protoplasm as the bourgeoisie. The working man who went to the music hall and saw Marie Lloyd and joined in the chorus was himself performing part of the work of acting. He was engaged in that collaboration of the audience with the artist which is necessary in all art and most obviously in dramatic art. He will now go to the cinema, where his mind is lulled by continuous senseless music and continuous action too rapid for the brain to act upon, and he will receive without giving in that same listless apathy with which the middle and upper classes regard any entertainment of the nature of art. He will also have lost some of his interest in life. Perhaps this will be the only solution. In a most interesting essay in the recent volume, Essays on the Depopulation of Melanesia, the great psychologist W.H.R. Rivers adduces evidence which has led him to believe that the natives of that unfortunate archipelago are dying out principally for the reason that the, quote, civilization, unquote, forced upon them has deprived them of all interest in life. They are dying from pure boredom. When every theater has been replaced by 100 cinemas, when every musical instrument has been replaced by 100 gramophones, when every horse has been replaced by 100 cheap motor cars, when electrical ingenuity has made it possible for every child to hear its bedtime stories through a wireless receiver attached to both ears, when applied science has done everything possible with the materials on this earth to make life as interesting as possible, it will not be surprising if the population of the entire civilized world rapidly follows the fate of the Melanesians. Mankind will be bored to death. Whew. Spot on. But please notice, in that, there's a comment there that the worst thing one can do is bring so-called civilization and try to spread it when it's no longer civilized. One is spreading something phony and false. And one is not bringing something good. Which brings us to the moment when Eliot hits bottom. Before one can begin rising, one hits bottom, and he goes down one step further in his poem called The Hollow Men. This I can read. It's very short. I'll do it quickly. Now, I want you to do one thing as you listen to this. It was published in 1925, 3 years after The Wasteland. The situation is worse. The lines are shorter. It's in five parts, but they're very brief. It seems almost hopeless. It is The Wasteland continued a few steps further. But buried in it is one more tiny hint of a solution that you can barely even hear when you first encounter it. The Hollow Men, 1925. Epigraph there are two epigraphs actually here. Mr. Kurtz, he dead. I'll come back to that. Second one, a penny for the old guy. You may recognize that one. One, part one. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men, leaning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass, or rats' feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed force, gesture without motion. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom remember us, if at all, not as lost, violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. Two. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams, in death's dream kingdom these do not appear. There the eyes are sunlight on a broken column. There is a tree swinging, and voices are in the wind singing, more distant and more solemn than a fading star. Let me be no nearer in death's dream kingdom. Let me also wear such deliberate disguises, rat's coat, crow skin, cross staves, in a field, behaving as the wind behaves. No nearer, not that final meeting in the twilight kingdom. Three. This is the dead land. This is cactus land. Here the stone images are raised. Here they receive the supplication of a dead man's hand under the twinkle of a fading star. Is it like this in death's other kingdom, waking alone at the hour when we are trembling with tenderness, lips that would kiss form prayers to broken stone? Four. The eyes are not here. There are no eyes here, in this valley of dying stars, in this hollow valley, this broken jaw of our lost kingdoms. In this last of meeting places, we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the tumid river. Sightless, unless the eyes reappear, as the perpetual star, multifoliate rose of death's twilight kingdom, the hope only of empty men. Five. Here we go round the prickly pear, prickly pear, prickly pear. Here we go round the prickly pear at 5 o'clock in the morning. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response, falls the shadow. Life is very long. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the descent, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom, for thine is, life is, for thine is the. This is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. That has become one of the three most famous lines in modern poetry. Not with a bang, but a whimper. The other two, by the way, are from Yeats's The Second Coming. Okay, things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The last one from Robert Frost, the end of... Two roads in a wood, okay? But I chose the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. It's the only one of the three that's positive at all. But if you really know the poem, it's pretty depressing as well. Now, notice what's... It's mysterious. The poem is short. The lines are short. It's as if the poetry itself is now as broken and jagged as the rocks that are mentioned in there. It is really desolate. It is really empty. But Eliot insisted that one could actually use the past to recreate work in the present And in his essay called Tradition and the Individual Talent, he made the point that in using materials from the past or writing a new poem, one was actually reflecting on the past. You could do nothing new until you absorbed what came before you. Which means the idiocy of all these so-called creative writing courses in high schools and universities is pointless, because until you know something, until you're filled with something, until you have a sense of the past, where you came from and where you are now, you have nothing to say. Period. So that reams are turned out of just meaningless googa and nonsense that aren't even as good as the nonsense poems of Lewis Carroll or Edward Lear. This is not a nonsense poem, and what Eliot is doing is transforming. So I'm going to do this in the time I have remaining. Let me do this. Eliot uses four sources to put this poem together. Let me take you through them, and then you'll see how his notion that tradition, what came before, is essential in order to do anything in the present that is new, unique, your own. Before you can have an individual voice, and he's now moving towards an individual voice, please notice how he is including himself in the poem in a way only hinted at in The Wasteland, because the hollow men begins, we are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. And he is including himself as part of that dead, empty humanity. Okay? He is, if you will, finding his own voice as he hits bottom, or at least admitting his complicity, or at least his companionship with all of those hollow, stuffed men around him. First one you should know better than I do, A Penny for the Old Guy. It's a reference to Guy Fawkes Day. And indeed, I'm told, correct me if I'm wrong, that one thing that isn't still done, it used to be done, is the children would make little straw mock-ups, and then they would burn on the 5th of November. Well, those are the stuffed men, head leaning together, headpiece filled with straw, okay? They're like those little empty straw mock-ups that just will instantaneously be burned up because there's nothing there other than straw, okay? Guy Fawkes commemorating what precisely? The discovery of the plot to blow up Parliament, the act of rebellion by the Catholics against the Protestant monarch, James I. Some now claim it was a setup. There is debate as to, you know, whether it was one of the first false flag operations. Nevertheless, Eliot uses it as an indication of an act of rebellion. Okay? And we'll come back to that. So, first, Guy Fawkes Day. Second, his beloved Shakespeare. He knew Shakespeare very, very well. Let me quote a couple of passages from a Shakespeare play you all know. It's a little number called Julius Caesar. First, I'm going to go to Act 4. They're both from speeches by Brutus. This is before the battle at Philippi. Brutus is in his tent. He's had his fight with Cassius. Those assassins who rebelled against Caesar and murdered Caesar have now split apart. Cassius and Brutus are now fighting against Octavius and Antony, and things are coming apart. The center cannot hold. We'll quote Mr. Yeats again, okay? And what seemed to be this, what's going to be a triumphant act, we free Rome from the tyranny of Caesar, and we'll have a wonderful new world. Instead, more rebellion, more antagonism, the wars are spreading. And Brutus is now questioning whether those men he is fighting with are going to be loyal to him. Division within the ranks, even among the same side. Here's the passage. Thou hast described a hot friend cooling. Ever note, Lucilius, when love begins to sicken and decay, it useth an enforced ceremony. There are no tricks in plain and simple faith. But hollow men, like horses hot at hand, make gallant show and promise of their mettle. But when they should endure the bloody spur, they fall their crests and, like deceitful jades, sink in the trial. He's talking about his comrades, who he fears are now hollow men, very like horses, like animals, that seem ready to ride into battle, ready to go, and okay, and we unleash them, and as soon as they get in there, they fall their crests, they turn out to be deceitful jades, and they sink in the trial. You put them to the ultimate test, they sink. Okay, we may rebel, we go forward, no we don't. Plump, down it goes. But please notice the title for the poem comes from that speech. That's where the phrase hollow men comes from. This is earlier. This is Act 2, Scene 1. The assassins are trying to convince Brutus to join them. And he's reflecting on it. It's by himself. It's a short soliloquy. Since Cassius first did whet me against Caesar, I have not slept. Between the acting of a dreadful thing and the first motion, all the interim is like a phantasma or a hideous dream. The genius and the mortal instruments are then in council, and the state of man, like to a little kingdom, suffers then the nature of an insurrection, an inward rebellion before the outward rebellion. And even once the idea is put into one's mind, between the moment of the thought going in the mind and the acting of a dreadful thing, it's like a phantasma or a hideous dream, this gap between idea and action, which creates part five of the Hollow Men, okay? Number three. This is a work that Eliot much loved. Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. It's where the first epigraph comes from. Mr. Kurtz, he dead. I mentioned yesterday the original epigraph for The Waste On was going to be the horror. The horror. The final words of Mr. Kurtz in the Congo before he dies. The vision that Eliot takes, well, it's what Conrad creates in the poem. It is a society full of deceitful, empty, shallow human beings who are going into the Congo. They send Mr. Kurtz there in order to, again, to bring civilization to the natives. What they're really doing is imposing their own emptiness. They are robbing the ivory, trying to pull money out of the Congo. And Mr. Kurtz, who goes in, as Conrad says, thinking he's going to bring to them pity and science and progress, ends up making himself a human god that these poor Africans worship, and what he brings is death, until finally they turn on him and destroy him, and thinking he was bringing civilization, all of which was phony, he actually is bringing the empty barbarism of the world he comes from, and dies with a vision not just of where he's been and what he's seen, but the phoniness of what he left behind. The horror. The horror. And then one of his servants comes to Marlowe, the narrator, and says, Mr. Kurtz, he dead. It's always been unnerving to me because my mother's maiden name was Kurtz. I feel some sort of strange connection, but one doesn't dwell on that. Please notice what we have in all three stories. The Guy Fawkes, historical, Julius Caesar, poetic drama, and The Heart of Darkness, prose narrative. Three different places in time, three different literary forms, one historical. In each case, it's rebellion. And what Eliot is beginning to look at in The Hollow Men, what he's caught on to, is that part of what the modern age is about is rebellion. hatred of authority, hatred of those who are in charge, and an attempt to remove them. And the reason we remove them is because we have a vision of a glorious future. If only the rebels can take control, the future will be glorious. I won't even make references to the Russian Revolution, okay? But what ends up, and Eliot is aware of it, is a total collapse, a complete collapse, and the opposite comes. What we end up with is horror, disorder, barbarism, blood, and more death. So that, going through the poem, we may be hollow, we may be stuffed, our dried voices when we whisper together. Why are the voices whispering? Because they're conspirators. They have to whisper together, but they have nothing to say because they don't know who they are, because they are nothing. They are empty, they are hollow, they are stuffed, and are quiet and meaningless as wind and dry grass or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. Supposedly, those kegs of gunpowder were placed in the cellars below, beneath Parliament, okay? Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom. Where are we living? We're living in death's kingdom. Where do we go after death? We go to death's other kingdom. Whoa! Remember us, if at all. So, remember us, if at all, not as lost, violent souls. They don't remember the acts of rebellion. They don't remember the glorious intentions. What's the only thing they remember? Remember us only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams, in death's dream kingdom. Now there's a different kingdom, okay? Death's dream kingdom. It's the vision of something glorious beyond that fatal action, which has to do with the rebellion and the false hopes, okay? These do not appear. There are the eyes in death's dream kingdom. Sunlight on a broken column, a tree swinging, voices in the wind singing, more distant and more solemn than a fading star. There's nothing there. Let me be no nearer in death's dream kingdom. I don't want to go into that. Okay? It's his earlier comment about forget politics. Politics is finished. You know, a Mr. Obama put up puppet president-to-be may speak of hope and change. And the wars go on, and the currency is debased, and the culture just sinks further and further into horror and degradation and vileness. It's, you know, hope and change. Shut up and go away. Okay? Just please. Let me wear disguises, okay? Rat's coat, crow skin. To hide from all of that, you have to descend to the level of an animal. Behaving as the wind behaves, neither here nor there, nobody knows who you are, becoming both. Not that final meeting in the twilight kingdom. We now have a third place. We have death's other kingdom, we have death's dream kingdom, and now we have death's twilight kingdom. What is that? What is twilight? There is still light. It's going down, but the light is beautiful, and the twilight is making sense of time. When it comes to twilight, we know where we are in time. And we may be at the end of something, and night may be coming, but before that happens, there is a strange beauty. Keep those three things in mind, those three places. They're distinct in the poem. Death's other kingdom, death's twilight, dream kingdom, and death's twilight kingdom, okay? Then we're back here. This is the dead land. This is cactus land. Here there are only stone images. They're raised up, receiving the supplication of a dead man's hand. It's an image of trying to pray. But we're praying to, quite literally, rock, stone, just stone images that are there. And what's praying? Maybe the supplication of a dead man's hand who tried to pray to the rock and died, and the hand is just sort of stuck there in the air. Is it like this in death's other kingdom? That's the phony kingdom, death to death. where one wakes up alone, the hour when we are trembling with tenderness, romance. Whoa. Lips that would kiss. Woo. Form prayers to broken stone. Don't have the energy for even romance. Love is emptied out as it is in the wasteland. What can the lips do? Phony prayer. False prayer. Praying to a false god. Part 4. The eyes are not here. There are no eyes here in this valley of dying stars, in this hollow, again, we're there in the emptiness, this broken jaw of our loss, in this last of meeting places, we grope together and avoid speech, gathered on this beach of the Tumid River. And we're at Dante again. We're at the dead souls at the shore of the river, waiting to be taken all the way to hell. We're also in the Congo with Kurtz, as those who are going to bring civilization, are waiting on the shore to be ferried down the Congo, to bring civilization to the poor, benighted savages down there. When they are savages themselves, they are bringing their own emptiness. Sightless, unless, there's the turning point in the poem, unless, what? The eyes reappear. He's been trying to avoid eyes. He doesn't want to look. He doesn't want to see eyes. But now suddenly, unless the eyes reappear as the perpetual star, suddenly the eyes may reappear like a star. We've had fading stars, dying stars. Now there's talk of a perpetual star, multifoliate rose, a rose that just keeps foliating, spreading out. What on earth is this? Of death's twilight kingdom, there is something over there that is beautiful, that makes sense, that not only that is perpetual, it is light, it is the beauty of the rose, the hope only of empty men. Well, let me quote to you. Canto 32, Dante's Purgatorio. Dante the Pilgrim, who's a character in his own poem, has traveled down through the Inferno with Virgil, his guide. Virgil then leads him out to the base of Mount Purgatory, and Dante and Virgil climb Mount Purgatory, and when they get to the top and are about to enter the earthly paradise, which is the transition point between the Mount Purgatory and paradise, the Paradiso, Virgil has to leave. He says farewell to Dante. It's a heartbreaking moment. He's been his guide. But Virgil, who symbolizes human reason, can know hell and can know suffering and penance, but he cannot enter paradise. Why? Because he lived before Christ. He is honored because he predicted the virgin who would bear a son. So he's allowed to accompany. Through human reason, he can teach Dante many lessons, but Dante reaches the top, looks around, and Virgil's gone. He looks back, and there, I fixed my eyes on her, Beatrice. Beatrice. The beloved one that Dante saw briefly as a young woman in Florence, and her beauty and her eyes transformed his life and taught him about the highest love. And she died shortly thereafter. And she died a virtuous, faithful woman. He knows she's in, you know, he puts her in paradise as the model. She is the one who went and got Virgil and said, you've got to lead this poor man, so that she helped him come that far. And now, in the other kingdom, beyond the kingdom of life, he is going to see those eyes again, unless those eyes reappear. And they reappear in the earthly paradise right before she takes him into the Paradiso. I fixed my eyes on her. They were intent on quenching their 10 years of thirst at last. Hadn't seen her in that long. I was bereft of every other sense. My eyes, walled in by barriers of high indifference, were drawn to her holy smile. They were entranced by her familiar spell. But suddenly my gaze was forced away to where the goddesses stood at my left. He should not look so hard, I heard them say. I was like one who had just strained his eyes by looking straight into the sun too long. Indeed, I was blinded for a while, which is why for Eliot, modern man can't look. The best we can hope for is to look at twilight. But the twilight is still there. The eyes are there. Now, what happens? What happens when he finally looks at Beatrice, this wonderful moment? She basically says to him, shame on you. You were given a vision of the highest love and you betrayed it. You settled for sin. You got lost in the dark wood, which is where the poem begins. The Blessed Virgin went to St. Lucy. St. Lucy, who was blinded, patron saint of the blind. Lucy went to Beatrice. Beatrice went to Virgil and said, Virgil, lead this guy out of the dark wood. The three ladies in heaven, through their communion and passing a desire to save this fallen soul, have come to him. And now he sees her eyes again and she says, shame on you. It's not, oh, happy, happy, I'm in love again. It's a sense of fallen man. Sin, shame. And he's climbed purgatory, so he knows what he's done. Now she'll be forgiving. But what do we get from Eliot? A whole civilization that has betrayed the highest love. A whole civilization that was given the incarnation, the sacrifice of the cross, the vision of the resurrection, the building of Western civilization, the glories of everything that was there, and gave it all up. Gave it all up. What is our only hope? Our only hope is finding those eyes again in the twilight world, feeling that shame, doing penance, recognizing our guilt, and trying to recover the little bit of light that's left for us, twilight. But God in his mercy will provide that twilight if we go seeking properly, and it will be a beautiful gift and a beautiful vision. And of course, Dante's vision, it's the perpetual star. It's the light that will never fail. And when Dante gets to Paradiso, it's a gigantic rose, an ever-unfolding rose, the symbol of absolute beauty. And you're going to hear a lot about that in the remaining lectures, because for Eliot, that rose is going to become an obsession, absolute obsession. Why? Because the hope only of empty men. But to do that, we have to become children again. And part five, the children's songs. Here we go round the prickly pear, the prickly pear, the prickly pear. Here we go round the prickly pear at 5 o'clock in the morning. Now, you know the song is, here we go round the mulberry bush, the mulberry bush. Why the prickly pear? Thorns. If you're going to recover it, you know, unless you become as little children again, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. We've got to begin again. But we've gone beyond the mulberry bush. What we deserve now is the thorns. We deserve to fall into the prickly pear and do some real suffering. And even then, it's almost impossible for modern man to act, to take those steps necessary between the idea, well, I need to do this, and the reality, suffer. Between the motion, I can do, and the, I can lift, I'll try to pray, I'll lift my hands, and the act falls the shadow. What's the shadow? The emptiness of the modern world. The emptiness that's inside us. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. Try to pray, for thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response falls the shadow. Life is very long. The burden of the modern age, the emptiness. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the descent falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. for thine is life is, for thine is the, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Whimpering little children, incapable of acting, incapable of praying, incapable of admitting, incapable of suffering, incapable of looking at, of refocusing on those eyes that could save us. And as a result, even if we all blow up, the modern world will send, and just, you know, what happened to the mind? Oh, it blew up. Was it a big bang? No, it was just sort of mealy mouth, sort of like listening to commentators telling us, hope and change, hope and change, hope and change, hope and change. It's a low point, but in hitting the low point, there is a real possibility of reversal, of recovery. Now I just turned it over. That's what I need. A couple of quick things here, and then you'll be free. What did I do with that? I'm so disorganized. I have these sheets here. This is a mark of my own emptiness. Ah, well. I know it's here. I just had it. Oh, and indeed, I have to turn the paper over. The things you learn as you age. It's very interesting. Okay. This is Eliot, 1935. What have I got to... Okay, I can do this. Talking about modern literature. There was never a time, I believe, when the reading public was so large or so helplessly exposed to the influences of its own time. They don't read anymore, but still exposed to the influences of their own time. I mean, it just pours in through the media and what everybody has to believe. There was never a time, I believe, when those who read at all read so many more books by living authors than books by dead authors. There never was a time so completely parochial, so shut off from the past. There may be too many publishers. There are certainly too many books published. And the journals ever incite the reader to keep up with what is being published or see the most recent movie or if you watch the new TV series or, you know, blah, 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 blah. Individualistic democracy has come to high tide and it is more difficult today to be an individual than it ever was before. I wish to affirm here that the whole of modern literature is corrupted by what I call secularism, that it is simply unaware of, cannot understand the meaning of the primacy of the supernatural over the natural life, of something which I assume to be our primary concern. What he is struggling for there and what he makes very clear is that he is fighting to restore the spiritual to literature. But before he could do that, he gives a clear view of the waste in which we live and the hollowness by which we live. And he does a remarkable job. But as I say, it's at that point he has hit bottom. But you may remember from Dickens' Hard Times when poor Stephen Blackpool falls down the open mine pit and they come to him and they haul him out and they're carrying him off. He dies as they carry him, but he says, as he was in the bottom of the mine pit, it was easier to see the one beautiful star above, which he'd never seen when he walked along the surface of the earth. I think that applies to Eliot, who probably fell into the mine pit, a mine pit of his own, but finally here, even at bottom, can see the star, the perpetual star, that becomes the multifoliate rose, and at this point, we're about to make a transition, because all the modern liberal gibberish of rebellion and renewal and making a better world, the liberal utopia, fails constantly and merely shows, as Eliot said, that these people believe the evil is out there, and if they can get rid of it, we'll live in a wonderful world, when they refuse to admit the evil is inside. And he will spend much of the rest of his life and his writing trying to do penance for his earlier life, and obsessed with the wrongs he has done, and trying to figure out how he can put himself right, and in doing so, he's beginning to figure out who he is. That's it for the morning. Thank you for putting up with me.